Okay, welcome all. I think we'll go ahead and get started, even though it's likely that people will keep trickling in. I'm always tempted when we have someone like Jerry here to say our speaker today needs no introduction, but I think we all need to be reintroduced every now and then. Here on campus, we probably tend to forget that most of us had a life before we arrived here and often did some interesting and important things that we need to be reminded of from time to time. So Jerry has been here since 1998 in the Department of Visual and Communication Arts. Was that what it was called when you arrived? It's probably called something else back then.
Language and literature when I arrived.
Oh, then there was a schism, eh? So he's been a longtime faculty member, and before that had a fairly extensive and successful career in directing and producing with Mennonite Media and in other settings. Finished up a doctorate in 2003, PhD in Media and Communication at the European Graduate School. And before that and since, has a long list of artistic publications and exhibitions and shows and works of various sorts. It's actually really interesting reading his CV, and if you ever have a few extra minutes and want some fun reading, stop by the office and I'll loan you his CV. There's a lot of interesting titles there that make you think, oh, I wish I could have seen that. I wonder what that was about. Welcome, Jerry. We're looking forward to hearing about this latest project, which I think is going to get continuing attention even beyond what it's been getting here on campus as a consequence of work he did during his sabbatical last year. So this is turning out to be a very productive and fruitful sabbatical. I'm looking forward to hearing more about it. Welcome.
Thanks for coming. It's good to see people that I know and value and respect. Here to hear what I have to say. Just a side note, and that tends to be my style of speaking. Occasionally I take footnotes away from this. You'll occasionally see this background. When I started the project at Wesley Seminary, I hung a paper about 10 feet long and 4 feet high, and I began to write notes on it and draw little drawings. Not intricate drawings, but just little charting, like this is what might appear here. And so I just took a photograph of that, showed you a little bit, simply to show you that this was a long process of trying to figure out and discern what I was going to do with this project. And today I'm primarily going to focus on what I learned by doing the project, not what I learned in the whole research phase previous to actually starting the art part. Because most of you understand what you do that. You read, you research, you interview people. You understand those phases. What you may not grasp is what you might learn by actually putting paint or capturing photographs with your camera. So for inspiration, I put up Picasso. I never made a painting as a work of art. It's all research. And that's sort of the motto I entered into this. But Laments for an Age of Sexualized Power is a response to a series of events, a meditation on who I am and how my church, and it was really important for me in this process to own that this is my church, has acted over the last 40 years. And I entered this project to understand, to lament, to confess, to interrogate, and to finally offer the images for conversation. It is clear when I started the project that I started with 7 times 7 as a response saying, no, we can't enter into forgiveness right away, 70 times 7, but also as a numeric methodology of constricting my work. Because I have discovered that, to your amazement, I am a workaholic, and that if I don't have structures around the edges, I will just keep going on and on. So my methodology for this project was to start by listening, reading, reflecting, and then doing work, painting, photographing, sanding, Yes, you heard right, sanding. Very important part. And then observing what was happening on the board and doing the process of listening and reflecting again. I'm also showing some backgrounds that you will never see because they've now been covered. I took photographs in the process, so like this was one of my early abstract paintings that I then began to work with. What connections do you see? And then you test these things differently without the preference for logic, meaning once you've entered in this space, you sort of park the logic on the shelf and you let it speak to you more with intuition, more with what is embodied in these images. What do I see living? What is the mystery? And what are you actually waiting to find out? I also have come to believe that you cannot do art of this nature without recognizing that you love the ones you are working with. This started with a bias toward the survivors of John Howard Yoder. I need to be clear about that. The real question is, could I also come to love John Howard Yoder by the end of this process? I won't tell you whether I did or not yet. Because if you don't love the people and the stories that you're working with, they don't cooperate in the creating of the art. But it also lets me discover, are there alternate stories that I must listen to? Ultimately, I know any project like this, and I've done way too many for my own good some days, is that you will enter into pain. And my discovery is always you get a gift as well. I want to stay up front, and this is not picking on the seminary. I am a seminary graduate, actually a graduate of the seminary John Howard Yoder taught at. But I wanted to test also, was there a point in this story where traditional theological ideas failed us? And I would like to suggest, just at the outset, then we'll jump into the art, four areas where I think the theology failed us, and what I would like us to maybe talk farther down the road about how we think about that. One is, I think we are often, and I put myself in this category, unable to understand how the act of theological writing and study carries with it an inherent power differential for those who are not engaged in that. Secondly, and this is a temptation for every one of us, we are concerned to protect our own project. So by giving preference to those whose theological language or discourse fits into our project, we disadvantage those who are not speaking in that. And I need to say up front, and we'll come back to this question again, but there were so many people in this process that said one of the following things or some variation. But we can't just stop reading him. You're not asking us to stop reading him, are you? But he was so intelligent. His writings are so important. And few of these responses ever got to the stage of suggesting that maybe these actions cause deep pain. So I want to say that I think sometimes that in protecting the project of his writings, we've continued the legacy of the leaders who refused to really deal with the issue. Third, when it gives preference to theological discourse over our embedded faith, which was something I thought was embedded in our DNA as Anabaptists. Walter Brueggemann warns of the danger of a prose-flattened world in which living the truth of the gospel is reduced into manageable facts or accommodated to social ideologies of either the right or the left. And fourthly, this is a new thought that came to me in this process, and so this is a testing thought. When theology doesn't recognize the potential losses that we suffered at the Reformation, when we rejected tradition, liturgy, and the visual arts. Because this gives us only one sort of pocket to hold all of our truth-making in, and that is theological discourse. That's my church. It still is my church. I just want to recognize that, thanks to EMU, I had a sabbatical that ended in 2010, and these were the three words that I came back with from that sabbatical. that I wanted my work to be incarnational, which means embodied, lived, breathed in the physical. I want it to be transformational. I wanted to see ways of acting and living and being differently than I had experienced before. And I wanted it to remain communal, meaning connected to the community of faith and connected to other working and breathing artists, theologians, and those. Okay, so what can art add to this discourse? I think art gives preference to the embodied ways of thinking and knowing. The lived experience often is more translatable, especially in my work, which has often been documentary, where I'm actually documenting how people live and think. That embodied way of learning has been very important to my development. Paul Tillich said, "The artist brings to our senses, and through them to our whole being, something of the depth of our world and of ourselves, something of the mystery of being. When we are grasped by a work of art, things appear to us which were unknown before. Possibilities of being, unthought of powers, hidden in a depth of life which take hold of us." Just a side note, this blue background ended up being behind these images here. That's what I mean, you'll never recognize them probably. As I think about this embodied way of knowing, I've come to think about what would have happened if during the early cases of John Howard Yoder, we had used an embodied approach. Because what I've come to understand is John Howard Yoder was brilliant and you were never going to win if you were going to have a theological debate with him. But I think, and my mentor was probably one of the prime leaders of this when I was in seminary, John Howard Yoder claimed to be doing theological exploration of experimental sexual expression. Theologically, we would step back and talk about that. Okay. But an embodied approach would say, no, it doesn't make sense. Especially, I would, as an embodied observer, would say, well, where are all the other men? Are you the only male that's capable of having these kind of sexual experimentations? Really, this doesn't work. Because we would look at the patterns of how this experimentation was being lived out. Art notices patterns, art notices textures, art notices what the body is doing. Okay, the second part thing I think art can do is that very thing, notices patterns, textures, what is seen, and sometimes what is actually kept out of the frame. I tell my photographers, it's just as important what's outside your frame as what's inside your frame. And I think that's very important. So art can ask us where the power is in this relationship, to validate this idea, this action. Third, I think art can change the perceptions of reality. Because, and I was just thinking about a conversation I was having with a person at my congregation last Saturday. He wanted to know what this piece of art meant. Well, does it mean this or does it mean this? And my answer is yes. Because art often can't be pinned down. It has multiple meanings and we end up with both and. It forces us to think deeper. It can dislodge stereotypes. I will note that it can also reinforce stereotypes. It can bring different pieces together, pieces that we've never considered, and it can bring new options. Fourth, and I was hoping that my art is not this, but I know that in some days it has been. Art is not a mirror held up to reality. It is but a hammer which to shape it. Art has and plays a role in social resistance, and I think that's important. So, when I left for Wesley, I planned to experiment with the merging of painting and photographic ink, something that I'd never done before, really, and I didn't know anybody that was doing it. And most people that have merged painting and photography, from my perspective, have failed, because it looks like two different things. They don't look like they belong together. But I imagined it like analog Photoshop, because some days, sorry Brian, I get tired of working on a computer. I want it to work physically. So the first painting efforts were primarily done with brushes, you know, because that's really the only painting I had ever learned was icons, and that's not very... But I discovered if I wanted the painting to carry the energy and emotion, I needed more paint on the boards, a lot more paint on the boards. So I began to use palette knives. They're wonderful things. And I would mix the paints right on the surface. Here you can see where I would start, say, in the far left, probably with some blobs of moderately dark blue, some blobs of teal, and some golds, and I'd begin to just mix them together on the board to see what kind of energy and movement I could have happen on the board. And then I would begin to imagine how this emotion spins out and how I might add more paints over here and keep going. And so I began to be able to get the kind of emotion that I wanted into these boards with the palette knives. I also noticed how things sometimes in the mix would actually mute the colors and it would turn to gray. Of course, we know that up here as artists, what colors mix together to make gray. But to watch it happen under the palette knife was really important. The other thing is that palette knives don't create smooth surfaces. They create disruptions and disequilibrium. And I discovered I needed a lot of that in this project. Okay, but now let's get to the project. What did I actually learn while doing these things? And if you want to say you're a really slow learner, that would be fine at the end. But so what were the discoveries? First, I discovered that listening is painful. When you go beyond the issue as just an idea, but begin to sit with the stories, experiences, and realities, it is painful. And one of the gifts in this project is that a number of the survivors of John Howard Yoder were willing to share their stories with me personally. That meant I had to sit with their pain. I started with mourning doves. These are actually mourning doves. I wished I had the sound, but I hadn't recorded the sound, but I photographed a bunch of mourning doves. I decided they would sort of accompany me through this project. They would weep with me, they would mourn, they would be sort of like, you know, at a wake you have the paid mourners. Well, these mourning doves were my mourners. But it was also a way early on to begin to test the techniques of all these painting. You can see here that as I began to paint and put on photographic inks and apply sandpaper to rip through and reveal, that these were my test pieces. But what did I discover in this process? I began to paint these yellow spheres in some of these, by the way. So I sort of, you can hear me, the mic probably won't pick this up for the podcast, but I'll talk about it. I was imagining us. This is all my colleagues in the church coming in to be with me as well. But I started painting these yellow spheres, and as a way of saying I'm shining the light on this problem. I'm exposing, I'm revealing. But I want to say what I also discovered is that to my being, they also began to speak of hope. That's what you discover with art, is that second meaning that you wouldn't necessarily think if only you spoke of saying, okay, this is about revealing, but instead acknowledged that in this process, you also began to see hope. And we'll return to that idea of hope later. While the paints were the abstract stories and emotional content, the ideas were not totally abstract. But I want to say that one of my heroes in icon painting, Sherard, says, "For an artist to refuse to enter into the living actuality of his time and place, including all that is most sordid, tragic, and wayward in them, or to refuse to speak in a language that reflects their temper and pathos, is to condemn his art to lifelessness and sterility." For me, if I don't enter into this space, it's not worth doing. Okay, that's the first thing. Listening is painful. The second thing I discovered is that breaking the sacred space is doubly painful. When I left for Wesley Seminary and the Luce Center for Art and Religion in the middle of August, took one carload of clothing and a massive hard drive with all my photographic library, which I think is about 11 terabytes now. But there were only images of three people on that computer hard drive that were specifically for this project. And you can see the faces there. As I began to look at these faces in those early days, it triggered in my head, hey, they look like Rublev's The Holy Trinity. Now, I recognize I'm not speaking to an Orthodox audience, so they say, what is Rublev's Holy Trinity? Well, that's your homework. You have to go look it up. But it's may be the most important icon in Orthodox theology. And it's three angels who are visiting Abraham. That's the historic story. But for the Orthodox, this becomes a story of the Trinity and how they have come together in a space of hospitality and welcome. So I began to look at those faces, and I began to arrange them similar to the way Rublev had arranged his faces in the Holy Trinity. I laid them out on the panels. I painted panels behind, and I did a couple versions of this because I wasn't getting enough action into them. And I began to think about what this icon of the Holy Trinity meant for the Orthodox. Because if this is a space of welcome that is being destroyed by this sexual abuse, that is being shattered, being broken, then that becomes important. If you read the literature on this icon, there actually is supposed, because there's a little indentation in the original, that he put a mirror on the front of the table so that when you went to the icon, you would actually see yourself being in this place with the Trinity. As I began to converse with students coming through the studio, which is the advantage of doing this at Wesley, is these theological students come wandering through and wonder what you're doing. And then they look, and then they really wonder what you're doing. But they helped me to understand that I needed to go even deeper into this subject. And I remember, this is early in the process, going back to my apartment one night, writing in my journal that I felt like a huge weight was just squeezing the breath out of me, and that I might not survive. And that prompted me to do one more version, because I felt like the students, well, they didn't really get the Rublev thing. They got this. Because I began to put in the symbols that were shattered and broken that they practiced with every Tuesday in their chapel at Wesley Seminary, when they would practice the Eucharist. So to understand that the very core ritual of the faith community could become a place of deep pain, that the church could be experienced as dangerous and unwelcome, to have the abuse happen within the context of our faith community is doubly painful. That's what I discovered. There'll be time for questions, so if you want to disagree, that would be happiness. I started the process, then the idea, as I began to work farther on this, the idea that dualities are dangerous to our well-being. I started to process the idea of how the church often splits body and spirit, making the body not as important as the spirit. Somehow this disconnect allows us to abuse the body without considering the spiritual effects, or allows us to blame the body without interrogating the spirit that is living within that body. While these ideas are not new thoughts, I began to question what Paul was actually saying when he talked about not male or female. And I'd love to have a conversation with those of you who are actually more Pauline scholars than I am when he talked about this. Was he really suggesting a different paradigm for how we see that we should begin to reject the whole idea of dualities? Was he suggesting that we are more alike than we are different? Think back to where I started. Is God one or many? Or two? That's another discussion. I began to think that in this process, we do this to fix the meaning, to describe the meaning by what is not, rather than by what is. Think about our elections. I'm not going to comment on that. But think about, we describe ourselves, we are not this or we are not this, rather than what we are. To validate our own positions by making other people's positions evil, inferior. And it was wise painting these panels, actually creating splits within the colors, that I began to question our whole dependence on these splits. This is done with Josie. She works at Wesley Seminary. She's also a dancer, and I began to chat with her about what would it look like for our body and spirit to be combined. So we played with that photographically. I began to play with the symbols of that. And then I began to pull images that I had taken over the summer in New York City to create another duality or question that duality, male-female. And I began to notice as I worked with these how it created like a wedge to create tension and open the door for more consumption, because that's ultimately what almost all the images in this panel are for. They're to create consumption in our culture. The cultural reinforcement to live at the level of the physical facade is immense. What happens is that we end up not seeing that we have more in common with each other as male and female, but we are separate, that separates us. And this duality is very personal for me. I have two children. I hope that they are not trapped by this duality. And I constantly work with this within my students, with their artwork, with the way they live and act. I also did a series called Objectification Addiction, which was the third of the dualities that I sort of worked with, watching how that changes us, removes us from our spirit, and values only the body, ignoring the spirit. And I think that leads, ultimately, if we begin to get to an objectification and then a consumption model, to an easy way to abuse. It also makes us lonely and feel separated. But that's not the topic of the day. Okay, so we're already halfway through the things I learned. Well, at least the ones I'm going to tell you about. You can't hide behind the scripture. Wow, imagine that during the election. I knew I had to do something with the Bible. I mean, after all, this is about sacred space. And I knew I had to do something that dealt with Matthew 18. Because as I read reports of the John Howard Yoder incident and talked to survivors and people that knew what had happened, he actually used Matthew 18 as a defense. He would say, you can't talk to me until the women come to me and personally talk to me about this offense, because that's what Matthew 18 says. So I decided that I would do something with Matthew 18. Now here's the little trick, okay? When I create these panels, all the photographic material you see, I print on plastic transfer film. You have to flip the image horizontally, or it's backwards when it ends up on the panel. And I made a mistake one day. I forgot to flip the biblical text. And I walked it over to, pulled it out of the printer. I had a big printer in my studio there. And I noticed that Matthew 18 was now backwards. If I laid it on the panel, it was going to be upside down or backwards. Now, I had two options. One, I could just be upset and quickly throw it away and print a new one. Or I could look at it on that panel, and all of a sudden it came to me that when you are behind the scripture, it is backwards. When you think the scripture protects you from everything and having to do anything, the scripture is backwards. You no longer can read it. You no longer can process it. You're trapped by your own accepted understanding and not open to any new insight. You are secure in what you think you know, but not open to exploration. Okay, so here's the other part about Matthew 18. Mennonites have tended to emphasize the end of the chapter. I think we should start at the beginning. Imagine if John Howard Yoder had been quoted this one. If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea. Okay, let's literally do that one. I'm not serious. But let's think about what that means. This is the beginning of the chapter, offers a distinct preference for the vulnerable, and yet we allowed the end of the chapter to be used against the vulnerable. A couple weeks ago, I had an exhibit of this. I only took half the show because of space, at the Transformation Festival in New York City, held at the West Park Presbyterian Church. They have two massive venues. And right before I was to introduce my exhibit, one of the speakers, Bob Brashear, got up, and he was talking about, so the whole conference was on transforming trauma. And he got up and talked about forgiveness and reconciliation. That was his topic. And what was fascinating, and he did not know this was going to be happening, was his admiration for Mennonites and our way of handling conflict. And he referenced the Matthew 18 passage and how we come together and talk about it and work it out rather than going to court and all these things. What an irony to have to then go to the other venue an hour later and talk about this particular situation. So I talked about it, and afterwards I spent some time with Bob because he had never known about John Howard Yoder's sexual abuse, but he had been a fan of the politics of Jesus. And so we had to wrestle with that. And, you know, that would be one, yeah, that's a whole other question that my art doesn't have to address. Thank you. But just the whole fact that I continue to meet many people. It happened at Wesley at least 5 or 6 times. I would have students who had just been reading John Howard Yoder in their class come down to the studio and then try to balance that. These are two of the students I met at Wesley. They had nothing to do with John Howard Yoder, but they had a lot to do with what it means to be in a religious situation where you are not believed or welcomed. Michelle and Ian were students I was getting to know. I went to chapels every Tuesday and met people. I sat in one class, met people in that, and then all the conversations in the studio. Michelle was active in the Black Lives Matter protests in Ferguson. She began to share photos that she had taken while being there on marches. When we talked about her own experience and I began to talk about the ideas of being shamed and blamed, in particular, which was often the case with many of the people that were survivors, talked about, both of them began to share their own ideas or their own experiences with being shamed and blamed, and began to discuss ways that they might photographically interact with this project. Here's another one of those, I have no idea why it happens kind of moments, but when you're in the middle of a project, everything makes sense, or you think it does. So I'm on my way to the grocery store one evening. I think it was Whole Foods, whether that makes me spend too much money or green, I don't know which, but you can. So Wesley Seminary is right next to American University, and then it's just like a half-mile walk to Whole Foods. And I was on my way, I'd passed American University, and I noticed these arrows, if you look in this photo up here, in all the traffic lanes around. Washington, D.C. has an immense number of traffic circle kinds of things. This is a really weird one there by American University. And I noticed these arrows there to define the direction that is expected for the drivers to conform to. And if you don't conform, you will probably create an accident. The traffic designers wanted to control the flow, the autos, buses, and pedestrians, so we'll have maximum efficiency. To go the wrong way on there is to upset the delicate balance that keeps the traffic flowing. I began to muse that in the same way, when a victim comes forward and tells our story, it's going the wrong way in the narrative of the institutions of the church or whatever, which make it much more difficult to want to see that flow go the other direction. So it becomes easier, as I read the John Howard Yoder thing, to sort of place the blame on the victim. And I would have people send me emails, you know, they probably wanted it, they probably were doing this or that, you know. They were part of it. So it becomes easier to blame the victim and then to encourage them to feel ashamed of what they have experienced. So the course can continue on its normal course. So fortunately for me, I pulled out my camera and shot a bunch of photographs. I got to Whole Foods a lot later, but when you're working on a project like this, it doesn't matter because there's no one waiting for me. So if I don't get back from Whole Foods to 9 o'clock and make dinner, it doesn't really matter. And I really enjoyed that part of the freedom of being able to get up early in the morning, go to the studio, and then all of a sudden realize it's already 7 or 8 o'clock. Maybe I should go back and make dinner. Decompress a little before I go to bed. But what struck me the most was my days in the studio were the number of students and staff who came to tell me their stories. And I almost always noted that they had to struggle with being shamed for what had happened and ultimately blamed as if the perpetrator had nothing to do with it. This is their experience. The behavior of the perpetrator was normalized, and all that needed to happen was for the victim to take responsibility for the fact that it had happened. Let me repeat that again. The behavior of the perpetrator was normalized, and all that needed to happen was for the victim to take responsibility for what had happened. Sixth, how painful and risky it feels to reveal what is underneath. For this project, I wanted to layer photography transfers and paint, and I began to use sandpaper. This is demonstrates some of the most abrupt ripping that I did with sandpaper. I also discovered that Brillo pads are amazingly good at ripping things up, and even my hand. So I would take these panels with the multiple layers on, and I would take them to the sink and put a little water on them, and I just rip into them with my hand. And I began to notice that it's in that revealing and that pain that you begin to notice relationships. I sanded away the smoothness and beauty of the images. I do like to be a good photographer. I like my portraits to be fascinating and aesthetically beautiful, but for this, I needed to rip them apart. If a panel looks too good, maybe I should just stop now. That was the temptation. Nope, got to rip into it, scraping, sanding. It feels risky to expose this truth, to break open the facade, to become vulnerable. The other thing I began to notice is when you lose the light, you lose the shadow. How can you reverse that? To not have the shadow, you have to lose the light. That's the risk we face. Because to be in the light requires that you also accept that there are shadows. What I discovered or came to understand, and I had not thought about this much during the reading process because I had been so survivor-focused, is that the church failed John Howard Yoder miserably. We let him continue so that we could use his theology. And when I read the MQR articles, I was broken by these letters that would come in to these committees saying, can you hurry up so we can get John Howard Yoder back? And I never heard that idea presented as so that we can help John Howard Yoder, become a better person. It's so that we have his theology back. Do you understand what I'm saying? That was so painful because this is not like I'm exposing some church that's out there. I'm exposing my own people. His theology became more important to the church than his personal being, than his body and spirit, than the person he was becoming. We preferred to let him live in that unwholesome tension than sacrifice his theology or discredit the name we valued. We did not want to force ourselves to do the hard work of scraping away the surface image to reveal the truth. Now, this is not to negate, and I want to be really clear about this, that I feel that we as a church also failed the survivors because we did not stop John Howard Yoder. We did not really acknowledge their stories, and we allowed them to continue to do it. I don't want to negate that at all. But what is revealed is that the leaders of my church sacrificed both the victims and put more future victims at risk and sacrificed John Howard Yoder to preserve the church. Their positions are because they thought it was the right thing to do. And I want to be gentle because I don't want to judge their motives. Because I studied with many of these people, and I did respect their thinking and their ideas. So my understanding will continue to be that they thought they were doing the right thing. But I would say that when you try to hide the shadows, you also are losing the light. And that's something that's hard to learn. But I did discover it on these panels, because if you just sort of try to hide the shadows and get rid of it, if you try to create a piece that's going to obliterate all that's behind it, because you can do that with photographic inks, you just need to make them totally dark. As long as you're willing to have a totally dark panel, I can hide all of that paint. Of course, nobody wants to see it. And maybe the last... This is the last, in case you're wondering, thing I want to comment on learning was that truth and grace are connected and can't be separated. And when I first started this, I thought, ooh, I'm going to like combine my icons, all these icons that I'd written in my previous sabbatical and the ones that I continue to write since I've been back from that sabbatical. I'm going to combine them somehow into this because they have this spiritual, and it didn't work, and I sacrificed that. But I had printed this center panel, the Blessing Christ, on a piece of plastic, and it was laying around the studio, and I'd put it on panels and look at it and say, yeah, probably not. But one day I put it on the panel and said, oh, that's the only way I can put and understand grace in this situation. Because if you understand, and by the way, the original of this is it still in the prayer room over here? The one I wrote? It's on this floor, yeah. Is that there are two eyes and they're asymmetrical, which is very unusual in the world of icons. And the idea is that one eye looks into your very being and knows everything about you. And the other eye offers grace. And I began to recognize that you can't have one eye without the other. It doesn't work that way. And that in a sense, to expose the truth is in itself an act of grace. Because it gets it out and in front of you and known. And that is a grace, act of grace, especially if they actually stay with you after exposing the truth. Grace without truth-telling is a cheap substitute, or as the Lithuanians say about decaf coffee, and I love this, coffee without coffee. I would say grace without truth is grace without grace. So what I discovered is that without the truth in the John Howard Yoder case, there is grace for no one, not the survivors, not John Howard Yoder, and not the church. So I would go back right to where I started today, or close to it, and say that if I'm asked now the rhetorical question, you aren't suggesting we stop reading John Howard Yoder, my answer has changed. Before, I always tried to be nice and equivocate and say, no, I'm not. Yes, I think we should fast from the work of John Howard Yoder for a season. I realize that this is a little pointed. I'm an artist who doesn't actually need John Howard Yoder in my classes. But I would suggest, I was going to throw out, you know, like, let's do it for 3 years. You know, it seems like a nice batch. But, you know, that's a whole nother question. I think we really need to understand the pain that his situation caused. We need to embody that pain, number one. Number two, we need to understand how it changed their lives. But we need to understand that our own dependence, our own willingness to sacrifice even John Howard Yoder for the theology that we think is so precious. And that when we do that, when we hold on to these secrets, we have begun to destroy ourselves. And so I would suggest a fast, not because his words have no value, but because we need to understand what it's like to be without them. We need to feel that in our own being. What shocked me, maybe not, but about this whole process is this exhibit in the end ends up not being as much about John Howard Yoder as I thought it would be, but about myself and my own church, about our own quest for power, and about our unflinching fear of revealing the truth. I do want to say I'm grateful for the friends and collaborators who have been part of this journey. Within the last month, another survivor, John Howard Yoder, introduced herself to me. I think they keep introducing themselves to me and saying thank you for telling the truth. I don't think we understand how important the truth is. And I want to say back to them, I'm just an artist choosing to see shadows so I can also get to play in the light. Thank you.
Thank you. I think my logic was put on the shelf part of the time, too, as I look at what you're doing and try to think about it in other ways. I've never thought about John Howard Yoder's thing quite in the way that you walked us through that. Do you your last comment though of taking a break from or fasting from John Howard Yoder's theology is actually art in some ways. I mean, it's beautiful, and I was wondering if like say a artist perpetrated the same kind of acts as an artist that John Howard Yoder, would we refuse to look at their paintings? Does theology, is that a category, a theologian, a category that you treat differently than any other artist or builder or who commits these sort of things? I'm kind of wondering if that is a special dispensation for theologians only.
No, I don't think so. I would say, since you brought up an artist, and his work is artistically, it's well-written work. I will never argue that case. I think for an artist, we would already have put them on the shelf if they were a Christian artist within the church, because we don't value that at the same level that we do the theological discourse. That would be my first argument. But yes, I think we should hold all of those to the same standard. I think John Howard is a special case in that we think he's so important to us. And that's why I think we have to fast, because I think that's why we were willing to hide it for so long, to not really deal with it, and in effect doom him to continually living in that along with all the survivors. So I think we, for me, it would be, it's a step of our recognition of our culpability within that. Because if you, and I'll go back to that question, you aren't suggesting we stop reading John Howard Yoder. If anybody had asked me that was really asking me a question, I wouldn't be thinking these thoughts. But every person that asked me that question was actually saying, no, we have to keep reading him. We can't live without him. I mean, I experienced that here, I experienced that at Wesley, I experienced that in two or three other locations, where we can't stop reading him. It's like, well, maybe we need to recognize what we did to him too. And please disagree with me, because it won't upset me. But I think we would do that to artists, and we should. And maybe the art would then be able to be reclaimed quicker if we actually told the truth right away. I mean, we have lied about it more or less, and I think we still are, because, you know, we write little acknowledgments in the front of the books, but we still there's still a lot of people. I mean, Wesley's a case in point. So many people there had no idea about any of this. They continued to read his books, they continued to study them, life just went on normal. And so part of it is even asking what our own responsibility as Mennonites is to talk about this in a more public venue.
Thank you for a very interesting talk, Jerry. I think my question, it might be a follow-up on Linford's. To what degree would you see John Howard Yoder's story and the Mennonite Church's appropriation of his teachings as analogous or not to our country's use of Jefferson's writings? In the recent past, we've come to recognize the hypocrisy of his owning people and writing about that and the likely abuse of the people he had enslaved, at least one. But we're not talking about stopping to read his writings. So how are those different or similar?
Wow. Is it dinner time yet? No. Well, I think they're... Yes, my point is we should at least be talking about it. I don't actually believe in my heart of hearts that in the long run we should stop reading John Howard Yoder. I just think we need a fast because we've refused so long to deal with it and to even ask the question. So for Jefferson, I think we should be asking, are his writings still valid? How did that relationship affect his own writings? Because I think some scholars are maybe actually beginning to now dive into John Howard Yoder and see at what stage this might have actually affected his writing, what he was thinking. Because as an artist, I tend to believe that we begin to embody, and that's got to come out somewhere, what's happening. If you look at the cultural wars that are happening in America right now, we have normalized some absolutely horrendous behavior because we refuse to question whether we should even listen to the person's words. So I think we should talk about it as a culture.
Jerry, thanks. Maybe one quick follow-up to that, and then a question I was going to ask, is that there was a recent celebration for the 50th anniversary of the National Endowment for the Humanities at Monticello. And it was a gathering of all kinds of people talking about specifically this, the legacy of Jefferson. And it was interesting because they said that Jefferson, early in our history, was a kind of beacon of freedom, but a kind of perverted freedom that was blind to the kinds of injustices that were going on in society. And that twisted way of thinking about freedom had this ripple effect throughout the whole throughout the whole country. And so what would it mean to tell the truth about his life and his past and make Monticello the beginning of a different kind of rippling out through the country of rethinking our past and the legacies of slavery and how easy it is for us to be hypocritical and blind to these things? And that seemed to me like a really strong, sort of powerful way. And I don't know what the analogy is to thinking about John Howard Yoder, but it seems there are different ways we could press into that contradiction. And
exactly.
And maybe just to say that. The question I had for you was you've done all this listening to all these different people telling you their stories, and I was looking at the pictures and the faces of the people that you showed, but those aren't the victims. So I was just wondering, where did those victims' stories like come out in the art? Like, where did you see them in the... Right, because I know that they're in there somewhere as you're soaking these up. But
they're in the abstract paintings.
Okay.
Many of them actually don't want to be identified.
Yeah.
And I understand, because there still is this idea of controversy. So they are in the... I took their stories and put them in the abstract painting. Abstract painting is not something I'd done really before, but that was where I could put those emotions, those feelings, and then build out of that. But also,
okay,
they influenced heavily, you know, if you remember the paper at the beginning, they influenced heavily sort of the selection of the themes that I was looking at. Okay, I'm going to look at shame and blame, because almost every survivor talks about being blamed for this or shamed by it or abandoned by the church. I'm going to talk about the pain of the space, because that's something that many of them talk about. But it became amplified by watching the connections in the art.
So at the risk of like having you over-explain a piece of art, because I know you might be reticent to do that, I wonder if like could we go back to some of those paintings you had, and could you walk us through part of the abstract pieces of the art, just to talk about it?
Well, this was my feelings in the middle.
Okay.
I don't know if you can tell what that means, but there's pain and light and trappedness and mystery, all those things. And you'll notice in this series, I did use a lot of gold paint because I wanted to keep the idea that within all this, there is this idea of truth. I should probably actually... just one other comment on the other thing, because it made me think. Okay, so I show Spike Lee in my film class. I think he does stellar, interesting work dealing with race. Okay, and I talk to my students about how important his voice is to us. But I also tell them that some of his films are very misogynistic. So what we have to do with almost everybody is recognize that we are complex human beings and we shouldn't be categorized into one little lump. And I would hope that we could begin to do that with, say, John Howard Yoder and even Thomas Jefferson, as you expect, that rather than thinking we have to throw everything out or have a perfect person, is that we live in this more mysterious way that we are human beings and that we're growing. I am not who I was when I was 20 years old, okay? And I have changed because, well, for the last 30 years, because of these stories that I hear. They have changed me profoundly as a person. We owe the people around us a deep debt of gratitude for how they have helped us become who we are. And so to think that any of us are parked on the journey is also a fallacy. This is probably the easiest one to see, Kevin, because you recognize the elements in the images without the faces. So for me, part of what I did is, this is also a statement about race. Do you notice that? Meaning I very deliberately, in chatting with students, thought about where they might fit into this so that I would be making a statement not only about race, I mean about the issue itself, shattered space, but how we've often shattered the space based on race, ethnicity. Meaning this is not, it's not only what sexual abuse does, it's how we abuse our power to shove other people out or to make them less important or subservient to our form of ideas. What do you see here? Okay, what do you see here, Kevin? This is the easiest one in the whole show. Rosie the Riveter. Okay, that's wonderful. It's the wrong answer if you were talking to me. It's only because you don't think about my massive amount of experience in Eastern Europe. For me, that's the Soviet worker, which again separated spirit from body. But it's also Rosie the Riveter, and I'm willing to have both of those interpretations used because they work. Okay, so then let me begin to build, I asked her, what is your spirit like? So I created in the abstract world sort of this chasm of floating, moving ideas, all these things we think, and have to let her pose. But then, this is the hard work. What do you feel like when your spirit and body are together? So how do you think about your body? Do you love your body? Do you care for your body? Do you see it as an extension of your spirit? Do you think that what you do to your body changes your spirit? These are the kind of questions we had. And then these are sort of like the challenges of being united in body and spirit. So I just took all the kinds of things from, this is mostly a lot of photos from around DC, because if I got tired of working in a studio, I'd get on the subway and ride downtown and take photographs. Because it's a good way to think. It's my journal, way of journaling. Yeah, these are too dense to like do in 10 minutes. Because this one has like 60 photographs in. I discovered that after a while you couldn't use traditional transfer methods. I started doing rabbit hide glue transfers and all kinds of stuff because it got milky. So I learned a lot of different techniques to solve problems. I'll end with this one to answer your question. Do you notice that I'm in this? Why am I in this? Kathy, why do you think I'm in this?
Sure, why
am I part of this story? I'm part of this story. So I wanted to forthrightly, in the exhibit itself, say, I am implicated by this. I am part of this church, and I refuse to say I'm not. Because I think that's dangerous when we sort of separate ourselves. Oh, but I'm better than them, or I'm more thoughtful. I'm part of this, and I'm committed to stay part of this. So I put that in. You'll see if you can see it. So I built, I went and found Matthew 18 in about, 10 different
languages and translations, and I began to lay that on there just to see what happens when you mass up all this texture of scripture. It becomes almost unintelligible. But that's part of what I was thinking about as I lay this underneath, that I'm hiding behind it. That's our temptation. Our temptation is to say, I know what this passage means, and I'm right. And I'm calling that into question. I did bury one of my icons, and this is fairly early when I had not quite given up that idea. Okay, I'm sorry. Sometimes we learn slowly. But I should put her in because she's an Orthodox woman who rescued Jews from the ghettos in Paris and was killed by the Germans. And she had this way of saying, when she became a nun, she told the superiors, the only way I'll do this is if you understand that if somebody comes to my door in the middle of Eucharist and needs help, I'm going to help them and not finish the Eucharist. Because that's more important than the ritual of the Eucharist. To say that to an Orthodox, probably a metropolitan, is not what I would call high on the list. It took her 10 years to get sainted because of their disquiet with her, what she said after her martyrdom, which is very, very long. Yeah, I think that gives you, I didn't really put any, none of the panels have a specific person's story in, meaning I listen to these stories and I let their emotions come in. Okay, so I'm hearing these three, four, six stories fit into this idea they were shamed. And so what does that feel like? What does that feel like to have that? What does it feel like to have your church, the place that you really love and value? I mean, many of these survivors were students in seminary planning to be pastors. Many of them actually are pastors. So it's, you know, this is an important thing for them, and have that space so devastated is really painful. So it comes out in those ways. I didn't do this as a documentary, I want to be real clear, meaning I didn't say, okay, I'm going to put this first story you're going to listen to is so-and-so, and the second story you're going to listen to is so-and-so. No, it didn't have that. It was more about letting their stories wreak havoc to my spirit and then responding.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, and I think it's a good challenge for us as like observers of the art to pay attention to, okay, where are the voices in the art? And I mean, in some ways, the difficulty of hearing them and recognizing them in the art is like, is a good challenge for us in life and in paying attention to it.
I mean, one of the most fascinating days with this exhibit when it was down in the Margaret Gehman is I did like five or six classes, and someone brought a class in, and no one knew what it was about. No one knew who John Howard Yoder was, nothing. I said, just go find a piece of art that says something to you. And so they walked around, and then I said, now tell the rest of the class what your experience of that piece of art is. No introduction to anything. And it really, I mean, artists love when this happens. They got it. They found stuff in the art that maybe I didn't even, connections I didn't make. That's why I like creating art, because it allows people to start a conversation about their own experience because something resonates. But they really got, they were close to the themes just because they got it. And I think that's, we need to, of course, this is my bias, so just take it with a grain of salt. We need to trust art more to influence us and make us think.
Thank you very, very much, Jerry. It was a thought-provoking talk, and also I think gave us an insight into the work and the calling of an artist. So thank you for that. Our next colloquium will be on January 18, and Chris Gingrich from our business department will be here to talk about the research he's been doing in economics in Africa. So it should be another really interesting presentation. See you back here on the 18th. Probably see you before that, but enjoy your holidays if not.